right. Hello and welcome to episode 3 of They Came From the North, the movie podcast with a distinctly Canadian perspective, whatever that might be. Every week, if you haven't been listening, we deal with a different director. We usually try to focus on someone maybe you haven't heard of. We'll try to throw in some big names as well. So this week, in what promises to be a colorful episode, we are dealing with 70s animation extraordinaire, if you want to call him that, Ralph Bakshi, who's a bit of a controversial choice among our teams. So, but first, I think it's probably a good idea if we talk about something we've watched recently. I'll just start by introducing our panel here. From the East, we have Steve Power.
Hello.
Hello, Steve. We've also got John Mercer.
What are you at there, Chocolate?
We've got, in La Belle Provence, we've got Gabriel Gerard.
Guten Tag.
And I'm like Andrew Ward in Edmonton, Alberta. So let's start off here by talking about something we've all watched recently. So I will start with Gabriel. What have you got for us?
A very mediocre movie and an okay movie, which I won't spend too much time on. So I saw Spy Kids 4.
Ooh.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually like Rodriguez's kids movie. I kind of dig even Sharkboy and Lava Girl, but that's my own problem. But Spy Kids 4 was still, it wasn't really good or anything. It's just very rote, and the new kids aren't interesting. Lame gags. The only interesting thing is the visual side of it and some of the inventions it comes up with. So that's all I'll say about it.
And Joel McHale's forehead?
The smell-o-vision scratch and sniff?
No, I didn't try that. No, Joel McHale kind of sucked in it, actually.
That makes me sad.
Like, Jeremy Piven was better.
That makes me want to baste my chubby cheeks in tears of gravy.
And the okay movie I saw was The Other Guys, the cup parody with Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg.
Two guys.
I got part of that.
Sorry?
Two guys I typically hate, but that movie was better than it had any right to be.
Yeah, that's true.
I am by no means a Will Ferrell fan. But, you know, I have to admit I laughed a few times in it, at least.
Yeah, it was pretty funny and entertaining, but still, I don't know, it's not something that I'll rewatch or remember in, like, even 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd forgotten about
it. How about you, Steve?
I checked out, this one is distinctly Canadian, for sure. I checked out Goon.
Ooh.
Starring Sean William Scott and Liev Schreiber.
And Marc-André Grandin.
But it was
such a shrine.
It was actually pretty awesome, I gotta say. I really had a great time with it. It was
J. Baruchel co-wrote that, didn't he?
He co-wrote, yeah, and for the first time in my life I watched a J. Baruchel performance that didn't make me want to gouge my eyeballs out. So that's good too.
You know? I have to admit, I kinda like the guy, but he's definitely someone who could totally understand why he was completely great on some people's
mind. The Trotsky was 90 minutes of ice pick under toenails material for me. Like, that was just, oh my God. And The Sorcerer's Apprentice, I get shivers just thinking about him in that movie. But he was a little more lively, he was a little less, he didn't do that awkward, you know, Michael Cera thing so much in Goon. In Goon, he was a very hyper character. But Sean Williams.
Well, he probably took the opportunity in co-writing it to give himself something else to do other than being like a junior Woody Allen.
Yeah, yeah, and it was all the comedy worked really, really well. It was really funny, like laugh out loud funny on several occasions. It was almost as brutal as Slapshot, considering Slapshot was released in the '70s. That's pretty hardcore. That's pretty impressive. And
Wow.
And Schreiber was great. He pretty much stole every scene he was in. It was.
I want to see this just for his mustache.
Yeah.
My important question is: does he still have the Schreiber tooth burns?
He does. He's got the friendly mutton chops on the gum. So, you know, it's
nice.
It's pretty awesome. And really cool little...
I wear my beard in his honor.
Really cool little bit of trivia about Goon. Schreiber's character, Ross the Boss, or whatever it is they call him, is actually... his character in the movie is a hockey player from St. John's, Newfoundland. And he plays on a team called the St. John's Shamrocks, which is... they have a reputation for being a particularly brutal hockey team. And what's hilarious about it is when the writers, when Baruchel and his co-writer wrote the movie, they just threw the St. John's Shamrocks name onto a team at random. And it was an actual St. John's hockey team up until, I think, the early 80s. And they were known as particularly hard-hitting sons of bitches. And what's even funnier is, I think it was there was a four-year span in the 70s where they won four straight years of local championships, and they were known as real bruisers. And my father and three of his brothers all played on the team. Pretty cool. Like, Dad's got a picture in his bar at home of the team pitcher, the last year they won the championship. This was, like, 74 or something. And it's him and his bro was all sat next to each other and then the rest of the team around him. And the headline on top of the paper clipping is, "Aggressiveness, the key to victory." Which I thought was...
They should bring the team back as the Ramrock.
I thought it was pretty awesome. But yeah, it was a great movie. The comedy was fantastic. Like, I really found it funny. Very heartfelt, very honest. You know, it didn't feel like, you know, one of these churned-out Hollywood comedies at all. But at the same time, it wasn't, you know, Men with Brooms either. It wasn't dripping with Canadiana and all that kind of stuff either. You know?
Oh, so thank God.
It was a really competent, you know, like, in the pantheon of hockey films, you know, there was always only Slapshot. Now we've got Slapshot and we've got The Goon. So, there you go. Yeah.
How about you, John? Watch anything lately?
Yeah, in trying to escape our bitterly cold North Atlantic winter, I warmed up by watching the Icy Wasteland of the 2011 remake of The Thing.
Prequel, sorry.
Premake. And, you know, it must be said, and I'm very pleasantly surprised because John Carpenter's The Thing is my all-time favorite horror movie. And this prequel was a pretty goddamn good time. I really enjoyed it. I don't feel it's as strong as the Carpenter movie. You know, the characters just aren't there, and it's not as much of a study in paranoia. But it was a very, very well-made horror movie, and I really love the way that a lot of the characters go out in manners that play directly into the scene in the Carpenter movie when they go to the Norwegian base. And you see the corpses all strewn about.
So it pays more homage.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not so blatant as you have to have seen the Carpenter movie to enjoy it. It mm-hmm. stands on its own feet really well.
I'm kind of afraid, looking at the trailers, I got the impression that it was maybe going to be so reverent that it really did just feel like a shot for shot. I mean, did you feel like it was its own animal?
So did I. And I was really pleasantly surprised because it could have been a train wreck on the level of the Gus Van Sant Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, I mean, let's just face it, it's a completely unnecessary idea, but it was...
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was executed perfectly.
I mean, especially given that so much, you know, one of the real charms of the Carpenter one is the uncertainty on either end, you know? We're not quite sure what happened before. We're not quite sure what's going to happen after. So it could have really killed a lot of the magic.
And, you know, my whole thing with the characters is, I might be missing things because I don't speak fluent Norwegian. Not as well as I would like to, right?
What's wrong with you, man?
Neither did the Norwegian characters in the Carpenter original, as I understand it.
But, I just really felt that, you know, there weren't as many characters. It was, I sit and I watch it, and it's like, okay, there's 12 happy-go-lucky Norwegian scientists. There's the one dickish Eurotrash scientist, and hey, that's Vaughn from Community, and then the main character.
Vaughn from Community, isn't it?
Oh, is he ever?
Man, I've got to see it now.
Right, well, and, the movie I watched recently. Oh, we're still on it. Do you want to keep going? Keep going, John.
No, I was just going to make a comment about it. It still amazes me to this day that 30 years after the movie came out, that Ennio Morricone score that they bring up a couple times in the movie still sends a chill right up my spine.
Yeah, it's one of those absolutely perfect minimalist scores that it tells you how much of a genius that guy was that he could do so little and still get such a strong reaction out of it.
It's the same thing to me as Jaws. All it is a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, what I watched recently was, I think, a movie that got a little bit of a theatrical release, maybe in limited markets like New York. I don't think it really popped up anywhere else except on video. But it's a 2010 or 2011 zombie movie called The Dead. Really original title. But it was actually a lot better than I expected it was going to be. It was certainly better than most of the low-budget zombie apocalypse kind of movies that are coming out these days. It had a bit of a distinctive flavor just in that it took place in Africa and involves an American mercenary who's the sole survivor of the last plane of expatriates flying out, which crashes. He washes up on shore and proceeds to try to make his way to a base. And it's, you know, it's got a really cool feel. It drags. It's not very well acted, and there's not a lot of content to it, really. I mean, it's pretty much just two guys walking through the desert. But you know, the realization of the zombies is really good. There's these sort of, you know, staggering pale-eyed guys. And, you know, it's a distinctive environment for this kind of movie. So it was pretty cool. I would say it's worth a rental if you like zombie movies.
I liked one zombie movie, and then I saw the same thing over again about 7 times, 8 times, so I gave up.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I'm one of those guys who, like, there's an appeal to it, mm-hmm. even as much as it's overplayed these days. I do like the vibe that you get with that kind of movie. So obviously if you're completely worn out on it, you're not going to find anything new here to win you over. It's by no means an original movie, but if you like zombie movies, it's a cool time. Give her a rent.
I'll consider it.
But yeah, as long as we are done with our recently watched, we might as well dive right into the sure to be interesting discussion of the provocative Ralph Bakshi. So, he is a guy who, you know, worked primarily on short films, worked his way up, did some TV. He worked on the 1968 Spider-Man TV series, and then really came to prominence with Fritz the Cat, the adaptation of the R. Crumb comic. Did a number of movies through the 70s. That was definitely his most prolific period. He did Heavy Traffic, Coonskin, a couple of fantasy movies, Wizards, and basically half an adaptation of Lord of the Rings. He never got financing for the second half. Probably one of his best-known movies is American Pop in 1981. It pretty much bombed. And he followed that up with Hey, Good Looking and Fire and Ice, rebooted Mighty Mouse with the New Adventures, and other than popping up in theaters again in the early 90s with Pool World, has more or less flown under the radar, and the 70s were most definitely his time. I'll start here with what we feel are the good, the bad, and the ugly of his movies. So we'll start with the good. And I guess I'll start with Gabriel. What did you think was the good in his filmography?
Well, I might be the only one who picked this one, and I'll go with American Pop, because I feel it's probably his most realized personal project. It feels very autobiographical, and it combines a lot of things that are interesting to Bakshi, which is the low life and the outcast, and puts it in a current story, which is rare for Bakshi. It follows basically a family through the 30s, 40s to the 70s, and the evolution of rock music with that. And it mixes in photographs and real footage with the animation, which is also a technique that he uses often, but it fits real well with American Pop. But at the same time, the story is very cliche, and the thing that saves it to me is really the animation and the feeling that it's personal to Bakshi.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I found, like, when I was watching it, I kind of felt like, again, I agree with you. It definitely feels like a personal project. Oddly enough, it's one of the movies he didn't write or co-write. So I don't know the history of it. I don't know if he worked in collaboration with a writer. But it definitely had that feeling of being very heartfelt. So, and again, yeah, like, you're right with the visuals. That's certainly the strongest part of it. It's probably his most perfectly, I guess, his most effectively realized, just straight visual movie, from my point of view.
And mixing all the techniques he loves, too, which don't have really in Fire and Ice.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's good to point out at this point, anyone who's not familiar with Ralph Bakshi, he did a lot of work with rotoscoping, which is where you animate over live action footage. So, you know, a newer example of that would be A Scanner Darkly or Waking Life, the Richard Linklater movies. And he also likes to intercut with some, you know, just live action stuff, or vaguely or supremely psychedelic backgrounds.
He often does back projecting too, where you see a car, an animated car, and outside the windows there's a real city going by.
Yeah.
I think American Pop is definitely his most accomplished. Like, I mean, if I weren't such a big fan of what I picked as my good, then I think his would have been, like, American Pop would have been my second choice. And for me, it was a surprise to me, because I was pretty familiar with Bakshi. I was pretty up on my Bakshi. And it wasn't until, I can't even remember what film it was now. It was something came out in, like, the early, or, well, I should say, that, yeah, the early, probably the early 2000s on DVD, and there was a trailer on it for American Pop. And I was kind of like...
It was probably Heavy Metal.
No, it wasn't Heavy Metal. It was something else. No, then again...
When Heavy Metal was...
It could
have been. Heavy Metal was re-released on VHS, that trailer was all over it.
Yeah, it could have been Heavy Metal on VHS, but I had never heard of American Pop. And, of course... I wasn't, you know, like, these were the early days of IMDb and all of that kind of stuff, so I never thought to look up Ralph Bakshi on IMDb, but I had read two or three books about the guy. Like, I had soaked up some material on the guy and stuff, and I'd read about the production of Fire and Ice, because that was a film I loved and grew up with, and I, like, it was funny that I'd seen Fritz the Cat hundreds of times. I knew there was I'd seen the sequel to Fritz the Cat, which I don't think Bakshi was involved in, but... When I first discovered American Pop, I was like, man, I really have to see this movie. And it was, John, it definitely was VHS, because they released an anniversary edition of it on VHS, and it had that fancy glittery packaging and all that stuff. And that was when I first watched it. It was when that was released, I picked it up and I watched it. And while it impressed me, like, it was definitely his most accomplished film. Like, it was definitely had the best animation of anything he's done in terms of quality. But... it felt really disjointed to me. Like, the trailer kind of flowed better than the movie actually did.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I had a similar experience where, this was really before I was even familiar with Bakshi. I remember watching something on VHS and seeing the trailer for this. And the thing that, you know, really captured my attention was he does a lot in this movie. He does a lot of these like super low angle shots of these guys strutting around. I mean, there's a little sequence with Jimi Hendrix playing Pearl Haze.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's eye popping stuff.
Really energetic.
Better than anything else. And, you know, I felt like I had to see this movie, and it wasn't until, you know, we decided on this subject for the podcast that I ever got around to watching it. And, you know, I'm not going to go into too much detail because I have picked this one for another category other than good. But I have to say, you know, there's, I think probably it's got, you know, the most personal vision, and he probably had the most invested in this movie. And just wanted to get 110% on every aspect of it. And it evokes every era, you know, going through from, you know, the pogrom and these Russian immigrants coming to New York. And, it sort of progresses through the 20th century, up until the early 80s. And every era is, you know, very convincingly, if maybe a bit, in a cliched manner, it's really well evoked. So I think he probably put a lot of energy into this one. And maybe when it bombed, he got a bit of the energy kicked out of him. I don't know.
I think it was his, this was really, I mean, Wizards was a pretty, compared to, you know, Fritz the Cat, which was big in college campuses and stuff like that, Wizards kind of had this cult mainstream following. Fox brought it out and actually had a bit of success with it. And I think American Pop was kind of his first real shot at the big time. It was kind of an experiment, I think, on the studio's behalf, too, to figure out whether or not this underground animation could translate to mainstream audiences. And I think American Pop was probably his most mainstream and probably his biggest budget picture.
Oh, I'm sure. You see the money out there.
Yeah. I think what that movie was it was a gamble made by studios that they lost. And I think in the end it cost more than them, you know.
Hmm. All right, well, how about you, Steve? What's your good?
My good is definitely Fire and Ice. The movie's not perfect. I mean, I'll freely admit, you know, it's not a film that is perfect. The middle act just chases its own tail so much that it's just this infinite loop. They're captured, now they're running, now they're captured again, now they're running again. You know, it's just...
As someone online today mentioned when we were discussing it, what middle act?
Yeah, exactly. The ampersand is the middle act.
Yeah.
But the action was so well handled, and it just, the animation, it's an acquired taste. I mean, rotoscoping now, especially when you're used to cutting edge CG animation and even like a lot of the crazy stuff coming out of Japan, movies like Appleseed and, you know, Ghost in the Shell 2 and stuff like this, when you sit down and you watch Fire and Ice, it's almost quaint by comparison, and yet the rotoscoping technique added so much to the lifelike nature of it. Like, every character in the movie is constantly in motion, whether they're breathing or they're just kind of like fidgeting nervously, or it's that actor's performance is really captured well in the rotoscoping, but at the same time, you know, it's got that appeal of animation.
Sort of like the proto Gollum, you know, in a way. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Before there was performance, after there was rotoscoping.
But even
and I'd say like
I look at something like Avatar, or I look at Gollum, and they're photorealistic. I mean, you know, you look at them, you got to kind of double take. But there's just something about the way the movement was captured. Like with Fire and Ice is the one I really noticed it with, but it was also there in American Pop as well. That just the way characters kind of fidgeted around a little bit, and like hand movements and head gestures and stuff like that. Like it really felt more real in the motion. Like the motion was just so smooth, it really felt more lifelike to me, I guess. And even with Lord of the Rings and stuff like that, because you don't get the same, I mean, you know, you get animators drawing on individual frames of a film versus, you know, a CG animator sitting down and using a wireframe to animate using, like, so it's a little different that way. Like, it's the execution is different. So, yeah, okay, Gollum's performance is overlaid over Andy Serkis, and, you know, Serkis's performance capture is all there, but that's exactly what it is. It's data. It's motion capture data. Whereas when you're looking at rotoscoping, you know, every flex of a muscle, every, you know, inhaling of lungs, every little twitch of hair.
In a sense, you know, the fact that they're looking, the animators are looking at it frame by frame, they don't have, it's almost like they miss the small details that they're capturing.
Exactly.
So they don't, you know, consciously overwrite them to to make their own choices.
Exactly, exactly. It's more of a, you know, you really capture that performance, and it really does feel like a lived-in performance. It doesn't feel like zeros and ones. It, I mean, like, as photorealistic as performance capture is, it's there. I mean, you know, it's you look at Avatar, and Avatar, I mean, the Na'vi and Avatar are gobsmackingly ridiculous. But there's still that something about Fire and Ice, that organic feel to Fire and Ice, the organic feel of the characters and their performance, you know?
Well,
Go ahead, Gabriel.
Yeah, I'd say as a pure animation movie, it's probably Bakshi's best, whereas American Pop is, like, at its experimental best.
Yeah, like...
And what really impressed me from Fire and Ice is how much... there's almost no dialogue in that picture, and you're still enthralled by it because of the movement and because of the quality of the animation
and beautiful backgrounds.
One of the things that struck me about you mentioned, Steve, like the action being so fluid, it showed me that actually, I mean, and this is probably the most complimentary thing I'm going to say about him this whole podcast. I think he had a real talent for action filmmaking. I mean, the action sequences in this, it's not just that the rotoscoping is capturing the actions. He's making really good choices in terms of how to choreograph it
and
how to cut it.
That was another point I was going to make. It's really kinetic. You know, it flows really well. The sword fights are really well.
Initial sequence, you know, where our main character is running away from those orky goblin guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's cutting, all of a sudden he's running across this abstract, sort of sketchy watercolor background, but you really feel the motion, and then one of the orcs just lobs an axe at him, and it's just cut and framed, like, to really get the sense of that motion across, and it's really exhilarating.
Yeah, and it's,
well,
the sword fight at the end when Darkwolf takes on Necron, and, like, even the sword moves, like, there's athleticism there. There's you know, these guys choreographed this. This isn't just something a bunch of animators slapped together. And because it's rotoscope, because they had to rotoscope it, it's not cut to pieces. It's not all quick cuts. And these guys are really going at each other. You know, these guys are really doing an amazing job at the choreography, you know? They learned all these sword moves, right?
And the thing good to remember about Fire and Ice is that Frank Frazetta had a lot of input in that movie.
And
you can see it.
Yeah, and that's also one where the action part kind of comes in too, I think. He probably worked on the storyboards and stuff.
I'd say he was definitely involved to a pretty big degree, and I know Bakshi, talking about Frazetta, I mean, he compares the guy to Rembrandt, he gushes, he fawns, he basically considers Frazetta to be the most talented man to ever stick a brush to canvas. And I respect that in Bakshi, but I know the guys did have their differences when they were making the film. You know, Frazetta wanted things done that just could not be done. And they did butt heads over it. There was a considerable amount of compromise on that film. And then when they were in the midst of production, I don't remember which studio it was that funded it originally, but it wasn't a major studio. It was like kind of one of these semi-indie studios, and they basically said that they had to knock the violence back because they were changing the rating. They wanted to go after a PG rating. They wanted to appeal to the Masters of the Universe crowd rather than, you know, Bakshi's typical hardware. Yeah. And Bakshi's response was, you know, well, like, you hired the guy who made Disney porn and the man who paints naked barbarian chicks to make a PG-rated, you know, barbarian film. Are you guys on drugs? Was, you know, essentially his response. But, I mean, he had no other choice. It was either that or the movie didn't get funded. And you can tell that they kind of wanted to cut loose a little more, but at the same time, I was amazed at what got in there. You know, I mean, I first saw Fire and Ice when I was about 8 years old, 7 years old, and it was one of those things. It was in the kids section at my local video store, and even the cover looked like a Masters of the Universe cassette, you know? So I picked it up, I brought it home, and I was like, wow! This is awesome, you know? So, I mean, I grew up with Fire and Ice, but it's, you know, it's one of those movies. I think, you know, yeah, there are problems with the script in terms of, you know, the fact that there probably wasn't one, and there were a lot of details that I know were omitted and were cut. Like, originally they said Darkwolf was actually supposed to be Necron's father. That's never addressed. You know, Darkwolf's name is never even said, I don't think, in the movie. You know, he's just in the credits as Darkwolf. So...
I think you kind of get the sense, though, like, I don't remember if I read a bit of trivia, but it seems to me that when I was first watching the movie, Even if it's not mentioned explicitly, I definitely got the sense that Darkwolf was supposed to be his father.
Yeah, and that was the other big bone of contention I had with it, or like when I want to pick nits, you know. Necron and his mother as characters were horribly underdeveloped. There wasn't really, you know. Why is he riding a giant glacier to wipe everybody out, you know, other than the fact that he can and he's the bad guy, you know? But it was,
and, you know, one thing that I kind of love it. It's this because it's so distinctive to this movie. Although there's an element of it in Wizards as well. I don't know if Bakshi just has a thing for weird pronunciation in female narrators, but this movie opens with this strange tale about Necron and he's a master of high. And it's just like, who is directing this woman? Like, why
say
does she
I speak.
Talk like this?
Say I speak.
I speak.
I really...
I should have got the guy who did the trailer to narrate
it. I really liked... kind of like one of the funny little things that stand out when you revisit a movie. And that was one, actually, when I reviewed it on Blu-ray, I really liked the voice actress who did Necron's mother. I really
I think she's the narrator too, right?
She might have been, actually, yeah.
I think she must be.
She might have been, but she definitely puts on a bit of an older crony voice for the narration. But there was something about her delivery that I thought was really cool. I don't know what it was. So there you go, that's mine, Fire and Ice.
Yeah. All right, John, I suspect we're not going to be surprised here. You're good?
No, you're not going to be surprised at all. I've got to go with Fire and Ice. And I'm going to talk about something a little bit different with it, though. But, you know, we've obviously gotten into the animation and everything. There was a period of about 3 days in my youth after seeing this movie in the kids section at Alan's Video, where I wanted to grow up to be Dark Wolf. And it's just, you know, he is probably the most charismatic character Bakshi's ever animated on screen. And that's pretty amazing for a guy who's basically, you know, a paint smear of black onto a generic barbarian body.
Yeah.
Right? I absolutely love the final fight between Dark Wolf and Necron. Right from the very moment when he first sees him, just, you know, roars out Necron at him.
Yeah.
does his classic warrior pose, the two arms outstretched and the axe in one hand. And I think there was another really awesome moment with him earlier in it with the, when he's up on top of a cliff throwing rocks down at the subhumans.
Mm-hmm.
It's night and day to anything else Bakshi has ever done.
Yeah.
And that's why it succeeds.
Was Darkwolf, I don't know the history of, like, when Frazetta developed these two things, but, like, I see a lot of his Death Dealer in Darkwolf.
He was actually... according to some, he was supposed to be Death Dealer, and Frazetta insisted that he be changed. Frazetta insisted that he create a new character instead of reusing Death Dealer.
Okay.
It had something to do with...
And this movie was written by Roy Thomas, was it not?
It was, yeah. It was actually written by Roy Thomas and Jerry Conway, who did all of the 70s Conan the Barbarian stuff for Marvel.
So there you go. When you're asking who Dark Wolf is, there he is. He's Death Dealer and Conan.
Yeah.
Right? Just... So awesome.
I think it had to do with,
you know, yeah. Well,
in the early 80s, I think there were actually Death Dealer novels. There were one or two novels released, and I think it was kind of a rights thing. I think Frazetta basically would have been kind of feeding off of himself if he had included Death Dealer in it or something.
Mm-hmm. What's
that?
Sorry?
Fire and Ice was 83, right? So yeah, Conan Fever was still probably running pretty high.
Well, that's pretty much what got the movie made.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to throw my good out there because, as long as we're talking about it, because it's also Fire and Ice.
Yeah.
And I don't have a whole lot to add at this point, but
I'll just add that the only reason I chose American Pop over it is because it felt more batshit than Fire and Ice, basically.
And
and Fire and Ice feels very Frazetta. Like, I feel in a lot of ways he's the real author of it.
And I think one thing we haven't discussed is that I liked about it is the Tigra character, who, despite being like this buxomy chick, is also pretty resourceful. I mean, she fights the bad guys and like she's pretty resilient. She's not just a damsel in distress that cries for help.
Yeah, she's no.
I think there's lip service sort of paid at the beginning too. Like, I want to fight. No, you're a lady. And, you know, beyond that, let's
oh, no,
be fair.
Say that is the narrator.
I don't know if I can. No, you're a lady. I speak.
Be a lady.
I mean, yeah, like, I'm willing to concede a couple of points there, Gabriel, but I think we have to be fair and say, really, she is there as eye candy primarily.
No, that's true.
She's got a pet panther. That's awesome. That's Frazetta.
Yeah.
That's I mean, semi-clad women with pet giant cats, that's Frazetta all over.
Yeah. All right, well, we may as well move on to our bad. So I guess I'll start again with Gabriel. What's yours?
I'll go with Fritz the Cat, which launched Bakshi, basically. But it's a very dated movie, a very 70-ish movie.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, that doesn't hold together well, that is very stereotypical, especially towards black people. The funniest thing to me is that scene where there's those chicks fawning over the crow, which is the black guy, and they're like, oh, the black guy, and he's, like, making fun of those chicks going for the black guy, but he's being as racist and ignorant as they are in his portrayal of the black people.
It's not a sensitive, rounded portrayal.
He's pretty ham-fisted.
But the reason he chose it for bad instead of saying ugly is because I think it still holds up as a relic of the era, and it's a very revolutionary picture, and I think it's it has a certain historical importance as the first X-rated animated movie. And I think there's still, I mean, the animation is still nice in it.
It's that pre-rotoscoping period of Bakshi's career, though, where it's a much more sort of freestyle, I don't even know how to describe it, blobby?
Traditional.
Yeah, it's traditional, but it starts with a guy pissing on the floor. That's like the first shot, I think.
I'll be the first to admit, it's not my ugly choice, but... Or is it? I can't. Yeah, I think it is. But Fritz to me is just, you know, it's just so ridiculously excessive. Look at me, I'm a cartoon.
Yeah.
My dick in my hand. Ooh. You know, I just. Oh, I don't know.
That's the thing for me. It's like.
Fritz the Cat was
like, I'm going to talk. All right. For me, it's like, again, like, you know, like Steve was saying, it's so self-consciously edgy, it's just grating. Like,
yeah.
I'm so edgy, look at all the stuff I'm going to do, but it's still done with such a juvenile sense of humor, sexuality, and, oh.
What were you saying?
I couldn't take it.
I wouldn't say I liked it, but...
Oh, you're on now.
It's not the worst thing he's done to me. It's just not very good.
It's better than World War II.
What were you saying, John?
Or is it?
I was going to say that Fritz the Cat to me has always just come off as an excuse for, you know, hipsters back in the day to sit into a movie theater and snort cocaine and right. It's,
I know it was, you know, it always had its reputation as being kind of a, you know, this movie that makes the rounds in college campuses on bootleg cassettes and stuff like that. You know, it was never really, I don't know what the word, it was never widely accepted, I don't think.
I'm terrified that there's a possibility that there's a whole generation out there who, you know, used this as pornography.
Oh, God.
And that terrifies me.
We've gotten to a dark place.
Maybe in Japan.
Oh. Yeah, this is a dark place.
All right, well, how about you, Steve? What's your bad?
My bad is The Lord of the Rings. Again, it's another one that I had, you know, in my youth. It's one I had from a young age. I grew up with it. I can't remember exactly how old I was when I first read The Hobbit. I was fairly young. So, I mean, you know, it was, for a very, very long time, it was the only outlet to Middle-earth that I had other than, you know, reading the books, which I did. I have done every year since I was about 12 years old. I'm a big Lord of the Rings freak. Let's just leave it at that, you know? Some people have Star Wars. I have Lord of the Rings. But it wasn't that bad of an adaptation. I mean, you know, people kind of, they look at it now and they look at it through the lens of Peter Jackson's films and stuff like that. And what people don't really know is that Bakshi's Lord of the Rings was Peter Jackson's introduction to Lord of the Rings. It's what he saw first. He had read the books.
I think he thinks pretty highly of it, too.
He actually does. And yeah. there are even shots in Jackson's trilogy that are, you know, shot from...
Like the ring raids in Fellowship when they see the hobbits, like when they chase the hobbits and the hobbits side under the tree.
Yeah.
I think that's straight from Bakshi.
Straight from Bakshi and Proud Feet, you know, at Bilbo's party and stuff.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, for what it was, I mean, it was Bakshi's rotoscoping technique in full gear. You know, it was going full steam. The effects worked pretty well. Some of the choices were a little bit daft. I mean, you know, portraying the orcs as, you know, people in burlap sacks with angry faces drawn on them. That was a little, you know, but I mean, he worked with what he had, you know. So, I mean, I know his choices were limited. But really the big failing was, like, the part that makes it my choice for the bad was he couldn't finish it. He didn't have the financing to finish it, you know, halfway through production. He's shut down, and they got to basically salvage a movie. So what did they do? They tack on the cheesy narration at the end of the Battle of Helm's Deep and call it a day. So, you know, it was sad that it was compromised that way, because I think, you know, if he had gotten that second movie to finish it, I think it would have actually came out to be a pretty, you know, a pretty decent flick, especially if he'd been given the chance to kind of capitalize on what he wanted to do. And, I mean, a lot of that did come about in Fire and Ice. Like, the subhumans in Fire and Ice were... I mean, if he were able to execute the orcs in that fashion, it would have been fantastic. And, I mean, there were some pretty large-scale fights in Fire and Ice as well. You know, you had the stuff at the beginning, the raid on Laren's village, and then the end of it when they were attacking Ice Peak. You know, there's some pretty epic stuff there that all could have worked extremely well to realize Lord of the Rings. And he wasn't given that opportunity. And it amazes me that he wasn't. I mean, when you're talking about something like The Lord of the Rings, which even in, 1975 or 76, I think, when he started production on it, it was even then a pretty beloved book, you know, but it was just, I guess, you know, it was kind of held up at that point, I think, as remnant of the 60s.
I think, you know, there was a lot of enthusiasm for Lord of the Rings building through the 60s, and... So, like you said, there's probably a built-in audience there, and it's kind of amazing that the studio didn't want to capitalize on it. And it would probably be looked back on a lot more fondly if he'd had the chance to finish it. I think people look at it as incomplete and somehow attribute that as a creative failing.
Yeah, yeah. When it really wasn't. I mean, the cast, like the Hobbits were great. Strider was awesome. You know, he had just that right mix of... You know, gruff mystique and nobleness. I mean, yeah, Boromir looked like a giant Viking, but, you know, you're looking at a movie that was produced in the 70s.
Yeah.
He didn't have...
John Hurt who did Aragorn's voice.
Yeah, so, yeah.
You know, you got some pretty solid actors in there.
Yep. And it was just, I don't know, it was kind of one of those things where, for some reason or another, I guess the stars didn't align or whatever, but it just, you know, it didn't come to be, and that's kind of sad that he never really got to finish it because of that. It's a compromised work, you know, it isn't what it could have been.
Hmm. I mean, my biggest complaint with it, I think, and I don't know if this may have somewhat to do with budgetary limitations and not being able to finish the rotoscoping, but it seems kind of arbitrary the way he cuts from fully rotoscoped stuff to kind of this weird solarized effect of live action. And it makes a lot of the sequences feel rather disjointed.
I think that was partially a stylistic choice and partially a budget choice. I think he just didn't have the budget to do what he wanted to do.
Hmm. All right. Well, how about you, John? What's your bad?
My bad is American Pop. And I feel American Pop is a, you know, it was a well-intentioned movie that just, for whatever reason, just had a couple of missteps that really kept it from not being a commercial success. That obviously wasn't in the cards, but, you know, being a real artistic success. You know, for every great shot in there, like this, that amazing scene, the World War II, where the German sneaks up on the American soldier while he's sitting down at the and he sits down and he plays the old German lullaby, and the Nazi soldier basically says Danke before he shoots him in the back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for every moment like that, I want you to play one of my songs.
Oh, God. You do that disturbingly well. My bad with American Pop too.
That trailer was burned into my head.
Yeah.
And like we were saying earlier, the trailer plays out better than the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they pretty much give the entire movie away in that. And
pretty much.
Yeah, for it felt over times, and you know, I said the word ham-fisted earlier for Bakshi. You know, that's pretty much what he is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guy has got all the subtlety of an anvil when it comes to conveying emotion on screen. Yeah. For every moment that could be considered or at some beautiful, you've just got these most low-budget ugliness that just really smear mud over the entire thing.
Mm-hmm. I made the choice for American Pop as my bad as well, and like
later on that box you wanted.
Going for it, but I think probably, you know, the thing that really kills it for me, or I guess I should say two things. One is, you know, the choice of music is some of the most obvious choice for period music you can get. This may be in part, I don't know at the time how overplayed these standards were. I'm talking about this in 2012. But it just to illustrate the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. Like you just know what's going to be played. And you know, when we finally get to the 80s, Bob Seger being portrayed as the height of popular music just makes me retch a bit. But also, I really hate the main character during the 60s, 70s portion. Movement in his own. I hate that. Like, he's such a, like, college idea of what a deep, profound, soul-searching guy is. And he's just like, man, you got any smack? Oh, yeah. I just want to throttle a guy. And that comes through, too, in Pete, who's sort of like the final incarnation of this multi-generational story. Like, he's he's so excessively mannered. Like, you just did that impression, I want you to play one of my songs. Like, I feel like the guy who was playing him was trying to act through the animation, like, to overplay it. Ugh.
I could definitely see that.
That's my two cents.
It's like a bad anime dub.
Yeah, very much so. But you can tell that all the movements and everything are coming from that guy. Somehow that makes it worse. Like, it's less forgivable that this was their first choice in how to portray this character.
I can dig it.
Yeah. Should we move on to Ugly? Or do we have the moral fortitude to delve into the Ugly of Ralph Bakshi?
My soul is prepared. How's yours?
Yeah, I can handle it, but I'm letting Gabriel go first.
Oh, no. I have to
bear the ugliness to us.
It has to be Heavy Traffic. which was actually Bakshi's project for his first movie. It was his pet project, and the producer told him, oh, if you want to make some money, let's do Fritz the Cat instead. And you can tell that it comes from the other movie. We know that there's a Bakshi in it, because it's about, like, struggling a cartoon artist. And there's a lot of worldview that is very problematic towards gay people and black people. And every character is a caricature. The parents is like, there's this mother is a Jewish, classic Jewish overprotective mother who almost wants to sleep with her son. And his father is like this, this hand, basically. And I don't know, I can't really speak about it because I barely remember anything because it was so, so disjointed and so horrible to sit through. And I was also, I was beginning to have the flu while I was viewing it. So just all in all, a horrible viewing experience.
I think it's unfair. I think you're kind of letting Bakshi off the hook by blaming it on the flu. Because if it's anything I experienced for my ugly choice, stuff happens out of nowhere.
I had to watch it 10 minutes in increments. It was just so bad, and it felt like 3 hours long. And I watched 10 minutes, played some Borderlands.
If there ever was a sweet escape.
Then go back, watch 10 minutes, and it's just horrible. Horrible.
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely illustrates that Bakshi maybe doesn't have the most healthy social attitudes all the time. I don't know if he deliberately goes as ugly as possible and thinks that's somehow profound, but I just get the feeling that, you know, the guy's just not that cool.
I think in his imagination, I think he's trying to make fun of everybody unless South Park, but he doesn't succeed like South Park does. He's just being cranky and racist and homophobic.
Yeah. All right, well, Steve, are you prepared?
Yeah, mine's an easy one. I took the chicken shit way up and picked Fritz the Cat. Again, I mean, we talked about it earlier. The movie is just so ridiculously excessive, so ridiculously light on plot, so ridiculously based on a ridiculous comic book to begin with. It's a ridiculous movie. It is. It's... Ooh, look at me! I'm a cartoon cat playing with my schlong! You know, it's so ridiculously over the top.
Got my dick in my hand! Yeah!
Shock me, shock me, shock me! You know, it has no...
Yeah.
It has no redeeming value as a film whatsoever, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it
it is just a pure exercise in excess for the sake of being there. It's like, you know, we sit down now and we YouTube people getting hit by trains, whereas in the 70s in college, they all sat around and watched cartoon animals have sex. Which is somewhat disturbing, I guess, when you think about it that way. But, I think all of the appeal of the movie comes from the fact that this particular generation who are used to watching Mickey and Goofy and Donald and Bugs Bunny and all of these guys traipse around in their happy little cartoon lands were watching, you know, a cartoon where an animated cat was playing with his member and people were doing drugs. Yeah. And, you know, in a time when playing with your member and doing drugs was really cool. So,
yeah. And I mean, you can't even credit with Bakshi with, you know, that, you know, minor bit of subversive, I don't know if you want to call it a credit to the movie, but I mean, you know, this is an adaptation of an R. Crumb character. Yeah. I don't think he was particularly fond of the product.
I imagine.
So, yeah.
I don't even know, like, it's kind of funny because I've
heard... Hey, John, how about you?
Hello?
Do you have another thought, Steve? Go for it.
Oh, no, just one last parting shot. I haven't even really seen Bakshi say a whole lot about it other than it made a ton of money. So
yeah.
I don't even really know what his attachment is to it, you know?
Yeah. I think he was certainly, you know, happy to trade on its success.
Well, he only wants it to make heavy traffic anyway.
Yeah. And we
well, thank God he managed to do that.
Oh, yeah, I'm very happy to have seen this movie.
All right, well, as long as we're done with Steve, John, what's your ugly pick?
Cool World.
Whoa.
If there ever was a festering turd of a film to have on your resume, Cool World. You know, following in the footsteps of, you know, something like Roger Rabbit, which... proved not only that animation and live action could blend fairly well, but also proved that Richard Williams is an infinitely more talented animator than Ralph Bakshi. what to think of Cool World is just, it's a mess. It's an absolute, I've never been able to make it through the movie in one sitting. It's always watching in 10 or 15 minute chunks.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, you know, you got Brad Pitt early in his career. I'm not going to say before he learned any restraint. It's like, I don't even know what he was trying to do.
Earn a paycheck?
You know, you got at some points he's playing the tortured, hard-nosed, hard-boiled 40s detective. And at others, he's Tony Montana.
Yeah. And if anything right. says hard-boiled 40s detective, it's Brad Pitt in the early 90s.
Yeah. It's Brad Pitt coming right off of Thelma and Louise.
Yeah. Isn't his hair about 2 feet tall in that?
I don't know if that was just one of Bakshi's animation tricks. I thought they rotoscoped Vanilla Ice's head on him. The movie is utterly terrible. It makes no sense. The acting is horrible. You know, when the best in the cast is Kim Basinger, you've got a major problem.
Playing a character imaginatively titled Hollywood.
Yeah.
Oh.
You know, for all back, she said, you know, I had something else in mind. They made me change the character around. She's a rip-off rabbit. Right? You stuff Jessica Rabbit in a white dress instead of a... Or, sorry, in a white corset instead of a red dress. And drew a different hairstyle.
Yeah, I mean, I remember... I was young when... I was 10 years old when this came out. And I remember the trailer pretty vividly. And as a stupid kid, even then, I was pretty aware that this was a Roger Rabbit ripoff. And, you know, I never got around to seeing it when it was first out. Which may be evidence that I was wiser... as a 10-year-old. But, yeah, I have to agree with you.
Well, one thing you have to say about it, it's that it's not entirely, at least, Bakshi's fault, because I know, like, they rewrote the the script behind his back, and the studio did a lot of meddling in it. I think they basically forced Gabriel Byrne on him, too.
Mm-hmm. To tell you the truth, though, man, with having experienced the rest of his catalog, rewriting a Bakshi script behind his back probably isn't a bad thing.
It's probably the best thing you can do.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Cool World, the original product.
The best thing you can do is not finance it, but as long as they're stuck with the contract signed, you may as well rewrite it.
Why would you give this man $25 million?
Is that how much it cost?
It was like $23 or $25 million, yeah.
Yeah, and it made half of its budget, I think. Maybe not even that.
Meanwhile, in Africa...
The whole thing about Cool World 2 was, I mean, number one, Bakshi was kind of playing on, he had been the last head of Paramount's animation division, and this was kind of, like, he was looking at this as his ticket back into Hollywood, and of course he went right to Paramount.
Yeah.
He apparently originally pitched it as an R-rated animated horror film, and the concept involved, according to Wikipedia, a cartoon and human having sex and conceiving a hybrid child who visits the real world to murder the father who abandoned her.
Which is kind of cool. Like,
does
I
he
could
boast
see that
the studio bought it in 5 minutes?
The studio signed off, and apparently the son of the head of Paramount Pictures completely rewrote it in secret, and then presented Bakshi with the new script.
I like to imagine the son, you know, this guy who rewrote it, hiding behind a bush, sneaking around behind Bakshi, rewriting the script and laughing to himself. I'm going to assume that's how it happened. Maybe a fake mustache here and there.
Well, I mean, either way.
No, felt goatee.
Yeah, paper goatee.
Yeah.
Either way, well, the original concept that was explained could never have worked.
I'd rather have seen that. I think there's actually like a germ of an idea in there that I think is kind of cool. If only trying to imagine a hybrid between a real person and a cartoon as opposed to just a human next to a cartoon.
Gary Busey.
See, already it's better. All right, well, I may as well get into my ugly here. And thirds.
Yay,
it seems to me like it was 2 weeks of fever dream, you know? Like, people talk about dream logic in the way that, you know, David Lynch makes his movies, but I think calling this movie, saying this movie follows dream logic is an insult to nightmares induced by food poisoning. Like, I have no sweet idea how Bakshi conceived this, you know, what the process was of writing the script. You've got these twin wizard brothers emerging in this post-apocalyptic world, and they fight, you know, in the prologue alone, they fight and then separate. And then eventually, hundreds or thousands of years later, the evil brother rediscovers Nazi propaganda. And it's not quite clear how he uses this. He turns on a projector, and instantly, you know, his horde of mutants are hypnotized into wanting to go and fight a big war. And sometimes it seems like he can turn on this projector, and it just alters the world, and his foes are terrified. So the science behind it eludes me. But what I understand is that magic good, technology bad, Hitler, you know, I'm kind of all over the place when I'm talking about this movie because I don't really know how to address the central concern about I have with it. And that concern is that the most sympathetic character with a speaking part in this movie is Adolf Hitler. Like, I hated every character in this movie. With a seething rage that permeated my entire being, I think I was audibly in discomfort when I was watching it, to the point where my wife wanted to move further away from me in the apartment. scenes would transition with no logic whatsoever. If I'm going to get anything out of the movie, the only cohesive theme I can get is kind of troubling too, because Bakshi's exploiting this, Nazi, presumably Holocaust imagery in service of a story that celebrates the pretty pure blood magic folk versus the muddy genetic material of the mutant, just kind of like a troubling reversal of a eugenics policy. And I don't know how I'm supposed to read this. Like, what the fuck is going on? Somebody help me.
I can help you. Mail me your copy of Wizards and we'll give it the, the Suspiria treatment.
I unwisely returned it to the public when I brought it back to the video store, which still exists in my city. This was a painful, painful experience. And again, I don't know who this was for. Wizards, stupid slapstick humor, and then you've got a scantily clad fairy with visible nipples poking through, but it's not fully adult because there's no real adult content, and I don't know what was going on during the creative process for this, other than lines and lines of coke
and lots of acid.
Yeah. Now, go ahead, Steve.
I haven't seen it for a while. It's been a while since I've watched Wizards. I missed it on DVD. I actually had a VHS copy because I still am. I can't even say I was. I still am a bit of an animation goon. I do like my animation. So, I did have a copy of Wizards on VHS back in the day, and I remember paying an exorbitant amount of money for it as well. It wasn't a cheap tape. It was, like in the $40 or $50 range, I think. And I remember thinking that it was pretty cool, but It was more, it was pretty much a straight-up exercise in style. It wasn't, I don't think it was really meant to be taken as a narrative so much as, just Bakshi kind of mentally vomiting all his thoughts on,
Hey, that's an apt term.
Yeah, exactly. But it felt like, long-form music video before long-form music videos existed. It was kind of like a precursor to The Wall.
I guess. I mean, something I found sort of a bizarre choice is he uses sort of these New York accent actors in a fantasy setting, which is kind of interesting. I mean, it's certainly not the first choice. Usually, people gravitate towards a sort of classical British approach of having these characters acted out. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting, but again, I don't really see the point. And it's almost like he wanted to bring his Fritz the Cat heavy traffic, sort of like gritty urban social commentary, such as it is, and put it in a fantasy movie, but didn't really know how to go about it.
Yeah, and
I
think it was kind of maybe his first shot at the mainstream,
Which blows my mind.
Yeah.
Like,
why he would think that was a good idea for mainstream.
did we not just mention the lines and lines of cocaine?
This is true. Someone did already mention the cocaine, yep.
Yeah. No, it was just complete, I've never really come up with something that has completely stumped me as much as Wizards.
Even not even the epic traffic?
But heavy traffic, the ugliness of it and stuff, it sort of makes sense in its own setting.
Yeah, that's true.
And Wizards is such a mishmash. And I understand, I don't know where they ever thought they were going. I think they were just trying to make a movie and let's drop a few tabs and let's go at it. I don't know.
I don't, yeah, it, like, I'd love to revisit it. I really would. And I may. Now that the Blu-ray is out, I'm a sucker for animation on Blu-ray, any kind of animation on Blu-ray. So I got a feeling I'm going to end up revisiting it sooner rather than later.
You know, Steve, I feel like somebody's just told me that they've been thinking about jumping off a bridge. And I feel like it's my obligation to talk you down. Like, you have a family, man.
I do. I know. And my children need their daddy. It's true.
Yeah. I mean, what if your kids wandered in while you were watching this and were hypnotized by Hitler and went out and tried to murder fairies in a garden? I thought of that.
This is true.
These are the dangers of Ralph Bakshi in the modern world. All right, well, I guess, given that I've just bared my soul, I'm going to let you guys take over again for a little bit. If you have any final thoughts on Ralph Bakshi and his legacy, because it doesn't really seem that he's going to give us anything more.
I'll say the guy is, I mean, like, he's an interesting cat for sure. I think his mind view, like his world view, is pretty narrow, pretty, you know, pretty blunt. But, you know, he's a talent. He did things that very few other people attempted or succeeded in doing. You know, like, rotoscoping, he proved it could work as an animation technique. I mean, yes, it was eclipsed by better techniques as time went on, but for a time, you know, he really was, you know, a different voice. And I think that was a lot of... He always spoke very openly about his disdain for, like, Don Bluth, Walt Disney, all of these, you know, marketing machines, he called them. You know, all they cared about was the bottom line. You know, he worked for Don Bluth, I think, originally, and was like, you know, I don't spend the rest of my life shackled to an animation desk churning out product. You know, and I can appreciate that. I can definitely appreciate that. And it would have been really cool. Like, I mean,
I would gladly watch, you know, The Secret of NIMH a thousand times again before ever watching anything other than Fire Nights by Ralph Bakshi.
it's cool when you look at, you know, some of the stuff he was working on that didn't get made. And I think, man, like, the guy's ambition was really there, man. And if only he could have been able to capitalize on some of it. Like, he worked on an adaptation of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. He had Mickey Spillane's Mike Hammer novels.
That would have been amazing.
Something Wicked This Way Comes, Ray Bradbury. Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, who he passed on to the guys who eventually made Blade Runner. You know, like some of this stuff, he wanted to do The Catcher in the Rye, with live-action bookends and, like, all the flashback sequences as animated sequences. You know, like, the ambition is there. Like, you know, if only he could have capitalized on some of it, I think he might have had more of a legacy than he does. I think he's a bit of a, like every other, you know, gifted filmmaker, he's a bit of an eccentric for sure, and I think he was just maybe a little too out of touch with the guys who signed the checks, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think, you know, given that his, you know, arguably his greatest successes are heavily in collaboration with another co-author, you know, it suggests that maybe if he'd had some, you know, had an opportunity to work on some of those projects, you know, maybe in collaboration with someone else who, you know, shared a view but could rein him in without completely sabotaging, you know, as with Cool World. I think I agree. You know, I'm kind of hard on him just because Wizards just piss me off to no end. But, you know, like, especially with your little sum up there, I have to agree. You know, he definitely brought a lot. He brought a distinctive voice to animation. And there has absolutely never been anyone quite like him in the industry. So, you know, I'll give him that. How about you, Gabriel?
I'll go the same way, and I'll say that, as much as the movies made were a mess and, morally not, offensive and racially offensive and all that, I think the animation is always mostly pretty good. And I think that's what kept him maybe from having this success he should have, is his worldview and his insistence of working out his, like, personal demons, shall we call them, on screen. And maybe he didn't work with other people as well. I can see that. I mean, in his movies, I mean, you can't imagine him compromising too much.
No.
Or collaborating real well with other people. But that could have helped me. I agree that that could have helped him a lot. If it could have compromised and just had someone to advise him instead of just doing what he wanted. And yeah.
Yeah. Hey, John, how about you?
I think Banshee works best as a curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Steve was saying, if you're an animation geek and you're at all interested in the, you know, the history of the whole tapestry of animation, you want to have a look at the outside of what came out of Walt Disney or that brief period in the 80s or 90s when Duck was a factor, or, you know, you want to step outside boundaries of Japanese animation. I think taking a little detour through Bakshiville is, it's an interesting, and, you know, if you look at stuff like, Fire and Ice or American Pop, it is, he's worthy of being watched, but I honestly don't believe that he's any sort of misunderstood genius.
Mm-hmm. You know, I agree with that.
I think Bakshi got exactly the level of success that he deserved to have in the movie industry.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, if that's it, I mean, I admire anyone who's managed to run this entire gauntlet of positivity. so I think that's a night. But I guess next week we will be dealing with the lesser-known Scott brother, Tony Scott. So be sure to listen to that. And good night.
Done.